ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Good morning. Welcome to AM. It's Tuesday, the 28th of October. I'm Sabra Lane, coming to you from Nipaluna, Hobart. A cancer patient from rural New South Wales is accessing cutting-edge medication that stops the growth of her brain tumour. Known as genomic profiling, it helps scientists determine what's driving a patient's cancer so it can be matched with targeted treatments. The respected specialist leading the organisation pairing patients with tailored treatments says the service should be funded to enable every cancer patient access, no matter where they live. Science is on the cusp of further extending lives and increasing cure rates. Joanna Woodburn reports.
When chemotherapy and radiation didn't work for 37-year-old Emma Sinclair, her doctor had one more option. He sent her original biopsy away for molecular testing to see if it could pinpoint what was driving her cancer. Her mother, Tony Edwards, says they found what they were searching for.
They were looking for a particular protein which they were trying to inhibit so that the immune system could then start attacking the tumour.
Emma Sinclair, who lives in the rural New South Wales town of Forbes, was put on a clinical trial of intravenous immunotherapy more than a year ago. It stopped her tumour growing. She says it's almost too good to believe.
It's a relief, but I keep expecting the worst to happen.
Her doctor, Rob Zielinski, is head of cancer services at Orange Hospital.
What we're really trying to find are these driver mutations. If we stop the driver, the cancer shuts down.
The molecular testing is known as genomic profiling. Emma Sinclair accessed it through not-for-profit group Omico. It was founded by the director of the Centre of Molecular Oncology at the University of New South Wales, Professor David Thomas.
With this information about what makes a cancer tick, companies have been able to develop drugs which are very specific to the changes inside cancer cells.
Omico was established in 2018 and works with public hospitals and research institutes around Australia to investigate other possible treatments for cancer patients and pursue clinical trials.
Cancer, which we've lived with forever as an ancient curse on mankind, is at a cusp where science could do for cancer what science did for HIV and COVID. It isn't something where nothing works. I think we're at a phase where the science can solve these problems. And I mean not only extending life, but increasing cure rates.
Dr. Zielinski says rural patients often struggle to access clinical trials.
I've got stacks of rural patients who are either, you know, too symptomatic, too much pain, too elderly, who are just the travel back and forth. If we find what I think is going to really extend your life and you just can't get onto it, it's too difficult, that's a tragedy.
Omico received more than $30 million in federal funding in March this year to continue its work. Professor Thomas wants the genomic testing to become embedded in Australia's healthcare so everyone can access it.
I would like to see this available for all cancer patients, certainly all incurable cancer patients, as an urgent matter, because we now have the drugs which can extend people's lives. It is possible to do this today.
Emma Sinclair agrees.
I think it should be available to everyone because it has opened up so many avenues for me, and it could do so for other people.
Cancer patient Emma Sinclair ending Joanna Woodburn's report. Australians with oral cancer are paying tens of thousands of dollars in out-of-pocket costs to replace their teeth because of a gap in the nation's healthcare system. Surgeons say an inequitable process is leaving patients with a dreadful choice to drain their superannuation or remortgage their homes to pay for dental prosthetics or go without teeth. National Health reporter Stephanie Dalzell has the story.
As a teacher for much of his life, John Mealing's mouth was once his livelihood. Now, it's costing him dearly. During a 12-hour surgery to remove his stage 4 oral cancer more than 2 years ago, John's jaw was reconstructed and some teeth were removed. But having survived cancer, the 73-year-old is now facing another hurdle, a $20,000 bill for replacement dental prosthetics.
I'll have to dip into my superannuation, but yeah, at my stage of life, at least I have some super. I think it's an anomaly in the medical system.
Jonathan Clark, Director of Head and Neck Research at Chris O'Brien Lifehouse Hospital, says while some oral prosthetics and the cost of fitting them for mouth cancer patients are covered by public or private funding, typically there are no subsidies for an essential part of the process, replacement teeth. He says as a result, patients are being left with an unthinkable choice: use their retirement savings or remortgage their house to pay for expensive prosthetics, or go without.
If we're talking about a breast prosthetic that's needed to be placed because of a woman having breast cancer, well, then that's covered. But if you've had your jaw removed and you've lost your teeth, for some reason, that's not covered. And I don't really have a good explanation for why there is this divide, but I think it really isn't fair that there is this inequity.
But having diagnosed the problem, Professor Clark and his colleagues have identified a short-term fix. At Chris O'Brien Lifehouse, 3D printing machines are being used to turn resin into teeth, creating what doctors call a jaw in a day. Oral and maxillofacial surgeon Tim Manzi explains the 3D printed devices are significantly cheaper than other prosthetics and can be fitted during cancer removal surgery.
It allows someone to go off to sleep in the morning, have part of their jaw removed or their cancer removed, and they can wake up with a brand new jaw and then teeth back in place.
Only a few hospitals offer the jaw-in-a-day prosthetics, and Professor Clark said Lifehouse currently did the bulk of them with the backing of philanthropic funds. He's calling for state and federal government funding so that patients who survive one ordeal aren't left facing another.
It's a bit like having a car. You can't drive a car with no tyres, and you can't restore form and function after mouth surgery without teeth.
Head and Neck Cancer Australia CEO Nadia Rosen is calling for broader funding for dental prosthetics so everyone can access vital care.
These people's lives are being saved by this complex surgery, but they need help to be able to put their mouths back together again.
In a statement, a spokesperson said the federal government was waiting for health department advice on an independent review examining the gaps in coverage for prostheses and strategies to address them. While the New South Wales government said affordable and timely access to dental services is a whole-of-sector responsibility.
Stephanie Dalzell and Selena Edmonds with that report, and you can see more of that story on ABC's iView. Now, warning, we're going to discuss last night's Four Corners program on the ABC about distressing new revelations in the childcare system. It's essential we talk about them because they show some paedophiles are specifically targeting daycare centres to abuse children, and parents have been kept in the dark about how the system's regulatory frameworks aren't working. And what's more, these predators have been discussing techniques for grooming children and how childcare is a place to abuse them in forums on the dark web. For more on this, I'm joined by investigative reporter Adele Ferguson, who's been leading the ABC's reporting into the childcare sector. Adele, what have you discovered about how these predators put this abuse material on the dark web?
They use encrypted sites using anonymising browsers such as the Tor, and that lets them hide online and access the dark web. And what we found was there's about 45,000 different paedophile forums on the dark web. Some of them have got over a million unique users. And what they do there is they trade information. And we got a Canadian Centre for Child Protection, which created a project called Arachnid that hunts child abuse material across the web. So we asked them to have a look on these forums for any chatter about childcare, and they came back with a lot of stuff. Most of it we were unable to use because it was just so graphic and explicit. But what it did show us is just how they talk to each other. They have paedophile handbooks, and they're saying where's a good place to go, and childcare is listed as one of these, and how to get in there, job interviews, what to say, what not to say, how not to get caught. It's really chilling.
This isn't the first big revelation about abuse within the childcare sector. What, if any, improvements have been made to protect children in recent months?
So the state and federal governments have come out and released a suite of reforms, including trialling CCTV across more than 300 childcare centres when there's probably over 12,000 centres in the country, banning mobile phones, cooperation between the states about working with children checks, and increasing fines when centres do bad things or clawing back funding. They're all good in theory, but in practice, they're not structural changes, which is what we need, which is what the experts are saying, that we need a lot more significant change for things to get back on track, such as better supervision for children, which means staffing levels. A lot of centres, 77% of workers say that at least once a week their centre is understaffed. When you're understaffed, there's poor supervision, and this is when bad things can happen to kids. They're also calling for a national childcare commission, which oversees this $22 billion sector, which is well funded and has the right people in place and has oversight and teeth.
There will be some parents listening to this who are very anxious. What can they do now to protect their kids?
One of the first things they should be asking is, who owns the centre? Is it for-profit or non-profit? Because while there are great for-profit and non-profit centres, our research has shown that 88% of the child sexual abuse happened in for-profit long daycare centres. So that's the first thing. It's also worth having a look at the staff and whether there's a lot of turnover. Are there a lot of new faces every week? Casualisation of staff, part-timers, people coming and going, that's another red flag for bad things to happen and slip through. The other thing is, ask what the quality rating of your childcare centre is. Is it meeting the standards? Is it not meeting the standards? And when was the last time that the childcare centre was assessed by the regulator? Because it's on average every 4 years. And the other thing is, parents should consider taking their children to body safety lessons, just so that they understand their body and when things are appropriate and when they're not.
Adele Ferguson there, and if this story's raised concerns for you or anyone you know, you can call Lifeline on 13 11 14. During the COVID pandemic, the federal government's coronavirus supplement doubled most welfare payments and reduced poverty across the country. New research suggests it's cheaper in the long run for governments to keep these initiatives and permanently end poverty. Daniel Ziffer has this report.
Poverty is expensive. Just ask someone relying on unemployment benefits, like Melissa Fisher in Adelaide.
It's really hard. You're making choices that nobody should actually have to make. Every day it becomes a battle of whether you eat three times a day or you see a doctor.
With an estimated one in seven people living in poverty, the deprivation is borne by individuals, but the cost hits everyone. Gianni LaCava is the research director of think tank E61 Institute.
There's extensive research that shows that poverty is associated with poorer rates of health, lower rates of education, higher rates of crime. So these are all costs to society as well. And we know that these costs are highly persistent across generations.
Those costs mean it might be cheaper to end poverty than to maintain it. During the COVID pandemic, a coronavirus supplement doubled most welfare payments and essentially ended poverty.
We know it lowered hardship a lot. We also know that people spent a lot of that increase in income. These are people that are really cash-strapped, that are going to go out and spend it.
E61's research is that the increase to unemployment benefits alone boosted consumption in the economy by between $4.5 billion and $5 billion. When Melissa Fisher received the COVID-era payments, she ate more nutritious food, could afford required medicines, and attended a gym. Her health improved. When the supplement ended, her diet degraded and she had to put off visiting the doctor or buying medicine.
A few years ago, I had actually been diagnosed with malnutrition and scurvy.
Without money for medicine, she's required week-long stays in hospital that cost taxpayers potentially thousands of dollars a night.
That's choices I've had to make, and I know the outcome of not buying the things I need for my health. But I also know that sometimes I don't have a choice.
Unemployment benefits are currently around 67% of the age pension.
The government body that examines the adequacy of welfare payments commissioned a report to discover what would happen if the JobSeeker payment, previously called Newstart or colloquially the DOL, was lifted to 90% of the age pension for nearly 830,000 recipients. Hayley Winchcombe of Mandala Partners did the research.
It's certainly costing Australians a lot to have this level of poverty in the country, and it's kind of that invisible cost where we don't look around and see necessarily the amount of burden being placed on our health system, on our homelessness services, on our justice system.
The data found every $100 invested delivered a $24 social return, including physical and mental health benefits and positive impacts on childhood development. There were other efficiencies too, like avoided hospitalisations, less interaction with the justice system, and lower lifetime use of the social security system. In November 2024, the New South Wales Council of Social Service released a report quantifying, for what it said was the first time in Australia, the economic costs of child poverty. Just in New South Wales, it found child poverty costs the state $60 billion every year, with $25 billion of direct costs to governments and the economy and $34 billion of costs related to diminished health and life expectancy due to child poverty. It's not a simple equation, because many of the potentially preventable costs won't be realised until poverty is reduced. But Kristen O'Connell of the Anti-Poverty Centre says the benefit is obvious.
Giving people enough money to live has immeasurable value in their lives and in the whole community.
Kristen O'Connell from the Anti-Poverty Centre, ending that report by Daniel Ziffer and Gareth Hutchins. Queensland teachers are considering a pay deal that could see every teacher earning a minimum of $100,000 a year. Under the proposed agreement, teachers would receive a pay rise of 8% over 3 years, as well as a payment of $100 a night for teachers attending school camps. But teachers say one major problem not being addressed is the increase in workplace violence. Elizabeth Cramsey reports.
After months of negotiations, Queensland teachers have received a much-awaited pay deal. Queensland Education Minister John Paul Langbrook says it's a historic offer that would ensure the cohort are the best-paid teachers across the country.
Every teacher will be earning over $100,000 by the end of this agreement, with wage rates that are very high for experienced senior teachers, $135,000, and principals at over $200,000.
The proposal includes an 8% wage increase over the next 3 years, plus an attraction and retention payment in regional areas, a $400 payment for first-year teachers, and $100 per night for those attending school camps. Queensland Teachers Union President Cresta Richardson says members have a lot to consider.
We really want our members to read the information that we've provided, that the government's provided, and make the decision themselves as to whether this is something that they want to accept.
The union has until Friday to vote on the offer, which would then go to all Queensland teachers for a ballot. And if it's signed off, back pay will be provided from October 1st. Other states are watching on. Justin Mullally is the president of the Australian Education Union's Victoria branch.
A Victorian government school teacher who is starting their career right now is earning short of $80,000 a year. An experienced school teacher, classroom-based teacher, is on just over $118,000 a year.
In New South Wales, the starting salary is $85,000. Justin Mullally says the best way to make teachers feel valued is by paying them properly, and it could also put pressure on those states falling behind.
If they can, for example, earn, as of next year, $15,000 more working in New South Wales, or indeed, if it comes to pass, earn more in Queensland, some teachers will choose to do that.
Professor John Buchanan is an expert on wages policy from the University of Sydney. He says Queensland has been falling behind New South Wales.
They had a settlement back in 2023 where the typical teacher in that year had an increase of between 10 and 14%, and for some school councils that was even bigger. So that has had a huge impact on the relative pay structure of teachers around the country.
Also included in the proposal is a $45 million behaviour boost safety task force to deal with escalating classroom violence. While that money is welcome, Professor John Buchanan questions how far it would go.
$45 million is better than nothing, but if the problem is as big as it is reportedly, I'm just not sure that that would be of a scale needed to make a difference.
Sydney University's workplace expert, Professor John Buchanan, ending Elizabeth Cramsey's report. That's AM for today. Thanks for your company. I'm Sabra Lane.
Hi, I'm Sam Hawley, host of the ABC News Daily podcast. Donald Trump is on the move, throwing his weight around in Asia. But will he have the upper hand when he sits down with the Chinese president, Xi Jinping, later this week? Today, Global Affairs editor Laura Tingle on why Trump won't be the most powerful man in the room. Look for the ABC News Daily podcast on the ABC Listen app.